This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. This morning, President Obama met with military leaders and called for a seamless passing of the baton to President-elect Trump. Obama told his Joint Chiefs of Staff that the American people are lucky to be served by such patriots. We have a big military presence here in Washington State. We report on it regularly, and now we want to air a problem. The U.S. military has an issue with heavy alcohol use and binge drinking, and a lot of service members who have a problem do not get treatment voluntarily. Well, new research from the University of Washington finds that letting soldiers assess their drinking habits confidentially and how that drinking is affecting them, doing that confidentially can help them cut down. Here's KUOW's Patricia Murphy with the story.
There are lots of reasons military service members are more prone to abuse alcohol than their civilian counterparts. They're mostly male. They're mostly young. And psychiatrist Benjamin Nordstrom says they're under a lot of stress.
Certainly the isolation in some of the posts, the fact that kind of culturally it's a closed, a total institution, kind of lead to essentially drinking patterns that are not always healthy.
Nordstrom is chief clinical officer at Phoenix House, a national substance abuse treatment provider. And he says there's another big reason why drinking is a particular problem in the military. Service members can't seek help without their commanders finding out.
A lot of it is kind of the concern about stigma. It's the concern about derailing careers. People really get concerned that it's going to lead to either them not being able to deploy, it's not going to allow them to get promoted, or it's going to get them into some kind of trouble.
Researchers have known for years that the lack of confidentiality in the military can keep problem drinkers from getting help, and a recent study showed the possible benefits of discreet intervention. The University of Washington School of Social Work invited soldiers at nearby Joint Base Lewis-McChord to examine their drinking habits. Posters that recruited soldiers made clear that their commanders wouldn't be notified. Counselors like Jocelyn Savage talked with soldiers about their drinking during a 60-minute phone call.
In just a minute, and what we're going to be doing is having a conversation about the role that alcohol or drugs play in your life and if there's any changes that you want to make. And I won't be here to tell you what to do or how to do it or anything like that. I'm really here as a sounding board for you.
The director of the study, Denise Walker, says this intervention allowed study participants to understand the consequences of their drinking without fearing for their jobs.
It's just a checkup. And with this project, another barrier that is really eliminated is they don't even have to walk into a building that would ordinarily say Army Substance Abuse Program. They don't even need to do that. They just need to pick up the phone.
The results were promising. When researchers checked back 6 months later, the soldiers in the study cut their average number of drinks per week nearly in half, from 32 to 14.
You can imagine the effects on your health if you're drinking 32 drinks a week and then go down to 14. But also 14 drinks per week is actually within healthy guidelines that the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse considers to be a relatively healthy level of drinking. So not only were these reductions statistically significant, but they're clinically meaningful.
But so far, Walker's research remains just research. The Army has experimented in the past with confidential substance abuse intervention programs, but has yet to roll them out Army-wide. Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Ivany is the Army Director of Psychological Health.
There has not been regulatory changes as of yet in that area, but what I can tell you is that the Army is looking at all the options in those areas to determine if those are possible, and if so, what the best way is to go about that.
Walker, whose research was published in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology, says she's contacted leaders at JBLM about the study, but has heard nothing back. Though the Army has long been reluctant to provide confidential substance abuse treatment, Walker says soldiers need what she calls a safe place to talk candidly about their drinking. I'm Patricia Murphy, KUOW News.
Thanks for tuning in today to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In the presidential election we just had, four counties in western Washington flipped from Obama and voted instead for Donald Trump. Now, Washington State has got a history of voting for surprise and outsider candidates. For evidence of that, I'd like you to meet one-term Governor Dixie Lee Ray. She won the 1976 governor's race, first woman to ever do that in Washington. Crosscut writer Knute Berger says Dixie Lee Ray was very accomplished before running for office, and she was pretty colorful.
She was a marine biologist, professor at the University of Washington, head of the Pacific Science Center at one time, worked in both the Nixon and Ford administrations. And in 1976, she came back to Washington State after being in Washington, D.C., and ran for governor and became Washington State's first woman governor and one of the first woman governors in the country elected not to succeed a husband.
What was the reaction when she announced for governor in 76 or 75 or whenever the announcement came?
It was a surprise. She was an outsider candidate. She had not been identified with either party prior to that. She declared as a Democrat, though she had been wooed also by Republicans. And I think people saw it as a kind of a breath of fresh air. She was an outspoken person. She was, in a way, a feminist role model. I think Washingtonians liked the idea of having a woman governor, and Dixie was very smart. I mean, even her enemies, of which they were legion, eventually, agreed that she was a very intelligent, witty, funny, sometimes bombastic character. And I think she just suited that was a period where people were looking for change.
Well, so what kind of governor was she, as it turned out?
Well, the best line about that was the line by Blair Butterworth, who ran her first gubernatorial campaign. And he basically said, you know, we thought she'd be the best governor we ever had or the worst, and she was.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that, she defied a lot of conventions. She made a lot of enemies. Now, you have to think back in 1976— we had just had three terms of a liberal Republican environmentalist governor, Dan Evans. Dixie was following that. The parties were aligned a little differently. There were a lot of blue-collar union Democrats in the Democratic Party who were not environmentalists. In other words, loggers and mill workers.
One of their jobs.
Couldn't give a rat's patoot about spotted owls and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And so, she basically ran as a conservative Democrat. And that was a coalition that Scoop Jackson had been very successful in cultivating. And he was our U.S. senator, one of our U.S. senators at that time. So I think she picked up this kind of fresh face, outsider, outspoken woman. I think that was the main appeal. I know liberals were kind of split. There were a lot of women who wanted to vote for Dixie, even if they thought she was a bit more conservative. She was not considered a doctrinaire environmentalist. She was pro-nuclear power. Those were things that were very high on her priority list and that she talked a lot about and that got a lot of publicity.
A surprise chief executive who made enemies, defied conventions, outsider candidate, thin-skinned as well, I've heard.
Yeah. Oh, yes, very thin-skinned.
So obviously the Trump parallel, is that absurd or is that useful in any way?
Well, it is kind of useful. They came from very different backgrounds in terms of, Dixie Lee Ray was from a much more working class background. But the knack, I mean, you kind of shudder to think what Dixie would have done with Twitter. there was a great thing I read where, she made no bones about identifying her enemies and pounding on them in the press. And many of the enemies were the press. She had a very bad relationship with the Olympia Press Corps. She lived on Fox Island, had a bunch of animals, a bunch of farm animals. She had a new litter of pigs, and she named the piglets after the reporters.
Nice.
In the Capitol.
Tip of the hat.
Shelby Skates, a great reporter who who she told, I think this was during the primary, she told him, he asked her all kinds of challenging questions, and she said, "You better come to know the term persona non grata if I'm governor."
Wow. Which we just heard with the little dust up with Russia, by the way.
Yeah. And one of the famous things that Dixie said was, don't believe everything you're told. She was skeptical.
Which Trump just said about the Russian hacking.
Exactly. She was combative. She was pro-development, pro, as I mentioned, nuclear power. But she also had other, you know, other qualities. For example, she had been a leader in banning the capture of killer whales, for example. She was regarded as very successful in operating the Pacific Science Center and moving it from being a kind of marginal operation to a much more sustainable and high-profile operation. And there was something just so Northwesty about her, so kind of eccentric. I think it really appealed to that sense of Washingtonians that we do things differently. And she was Exhibit A.
So with all that in mind, Knut, as we're anticipating President Trump, can we learn anything from Governor Dixie Lee Ray?
I was back in the mid-80s, I was up at a Democratic meeting up in Snohomish County, and I asked a guy who was a former Dixie Lee Ray appointee what had gone wrong. When she ran for re-election after her 4-year, she lost in the primary. I mean, she became very unpopular during her governorship. And he said she had a fatal flaw as a politician, which is she never remembered her friends. She never forgot her enemies. So in politics, you have to do a little of both of those things. You have to compromise. You have to schmooze and reach across and make deals and that kind of thing.
Reward your allies.
And that was a bit of a problem with her. She got crosswise with both Democrats and Republicans on just the stuff of retail, everyday politics. And so, you know, that is a lesson, is if you are going to be that populist outsider who sort of changes the rules and that kind of thing, you have to be good enough at the other side of it to make that work, because people will only put up with so much. You'll develop so many roadblocks to your agenda. You can't just be a sort of pure reactionary.
Remembering our Washington's maverick chief executive, the late Governor Dixie Lee Ray, that is the Mossback Crosscut columnist, Knut Berger. Thanks, Knut.
Thank you, Bill.
Now, I know that Dixie Lee Ray sounds like the name of the governor of Alabama. Actually, she ran this state, Washington's first woman governor, from 1976 to 1980, back in the time when killer volcanoes erupted around here. Now, speaking of elections, yesterday on this show, we heard a Trump supporter and a Clinton supporter have a calm, respectful discussion about politics. Jermaine Cornegay and Bill Orsborn were friends before the election, and they're still talking to each other. Weird, right? If you missed it, it's worth going to KUOW.org and listening to that. Now, did your friendships survive this election? We asked listeners that yesterday, and Elizabeth in Greenwood said no. In fact, my friendships did not survive.
I lost my best friend over this past presidential election. She and I have been on the same political page for over a decade, and we care about all the same issues. But I was a serious Bernie Sanders supporter, and she was with her. My friend simply couldn't forgive me for supporting an old white man who wouldn't stop shouting and pointing his finger at her. And I couldn't forgive her for supporting someone who was sold on fracking, in bed with Wall Street donors, and promised to push harder into Syria in her last debate with Trump. My friend felt I was a bad feminist for not supporting Hillary, and I felt that she was a bad Democrat for not standing with the only candidate who addressed all the issues that the Democrats are actually supposed to care about. I can't forgive Hillary for using her machine to squash the candidate who would have beat Trump, and I will certainly never forgive Hillary for stealing my girl.
Wow. Elizabeth, I want to know how you resolve this. Are you seriously permanently losing your best friend over Bernie versus Hillary? because you just described her position. I thought it was so empathetic. It sounded like you really can understand how she feels about you and Bernie. And can you start there? Can you repair your relationship? Please call us, Elizabeth. Maybe bring your ex-friend in and we'll talk it out together. We can do. I would be happy to do that. Now, those of you who are listening, and if you're not Elizabeth, perhaps you have a story to tell. Do you have advice for healing an election breakup? Is that possible? Give us a call here. We're at 206-221-3663. KUOW's The Record, 206-221-3663. And we're live tweeting right now at KUOW. It's KUOW's The Record. Welcome, I'm Bill Radke. Have you heard the phrase, journalism so white? Well, here's an example. In radio newsrooms across America, only 13% of journalists are people of color. That's according to The Atlantic. And it's a problem that KUOW's general manager has seen at all stages of her career. Karen Mathis told KUOW's Jamala Henderson a story about one of her first jobs as a radio reporter in Ohio.
There was a robbery at a used car dealership. And, you know, this person who had been held at gunpoint, apparently the perpetrator had been a black male, and she was, you know, throwing the N-word all around. And I'm thinking, wow, this is 1970 what? And she looked at me and she goes, I didn't know they had colored reporters. And so what do you say to that? What do you say to that? And
did you say anything to that?
I just kind of shrugged and, you know, had my microphone and I was there. And so you just push on. When I was in television news, it was a struggle because everybody had an opinion on what you ought to be as a black reporter. And I remember one year I heard from black people that you didn't interview enough black people. Well, I'd be motioning people over and people were shy, like, no, I don't want to be on camera. And then, you know, the next year I was on a mission. I was going to get black people on camera. And then you hear from white people saying, why is she only interviewing black people? And it's like, okay, I'm just damned if I do, damned if I don't. And that mantle of being a reporter and trying to be friendly and smile, you know, that got me out of some situations that were very uncomfortable.
What are some of the ways that you feel acutely like a black person here in Seattle?
Yeah. Well, I tweeted about this my first Christmas here. And I remember a Saturday where I searched for 6 hours for a black Santa. I found a beautiful black Santa. He was in the bargain bin at a JCPenney, and I scooped him up, and I was so excited. I'd been searching for 6 hours, and I went to the cashier, and I said, do you have any other items like this? Do you have any brown skin angels? And without missing a beat, this salesperson said, oh, we don't do that politically correct stuff. And I was dumbfounded. I thought, okay, items the color of 90% of the population of the earth are too politically correct. And that was like, wow.
What's the importance to have a brown-skinned Santa?
Well, it's just like with the news or any medium. You want to see and hear yourself. You know, it's important for public radio to be more diverse because if people don't see and hear themselves, see and hear their perspectives, their stories, their challenges, how they're personally living the news, if you never see that reflected, you're going to dismiss that medium as irrelevant, not resonant to you.
What are some of the mistakes that you see media making when it comes to race? You know, mistakes where that might make you think they needed some more perspective there.
I start screaming and throwing things at the TV or radio every time I see a panel discussion where it's an issue of concern to a population of color and it's all white faces around the table. Or if it's something to deal with women and it's all male faces around the table. That is such a simple level at which to, you know, you could try to get some diversity, and the fact that regularly news entities do not, just that makes me insane. Because it's like, you know, you don't know, you know, one or two other people of color or women that you could have invited into this panel to discuss this. That makes me crazy. I think any time there's not a representative voice in the mix, it's not correct. Because then you're having people who have not lived that truth, extrapolating, interpolating, fantasizing about what that life experience is like.
You've risen through the ranks of journalism to become a general manager. People of color, sometimes, you know, we don't all want to be representative of our quote-unquote race.
It gets weary being an ambassador. Yeah, it does.
Yeah, being the ambassador in the room just by default sometimes.
Yeah.
And you've gotten to the point where you're a leader and you're a person of color. What would you say to a room full of white journalists about covering issues of race?
Wow. I hate to keep banging the same drum, but I think the solution and the remedy and the right path is more voices and perspectives. Now, I know there was a point in time when that was hard. I mean, one of the most vivid, huge news stories that really exploded onto my brain when I was very small. I came home from school and my maternal grandmother lived right next door. And so my grandmother and my mother were watching the TV and crying. And I'm thinking, what's happened? They were seeing film of people being mistreated at the Selma march and, you know, fire hoses being turned on these kids, you know, young kids marching for equal rights. And I said, Mom, do we know those people? And my mom said, yeah, we know them. They're us. And it's like, wow. And I remember thinking, what would have happened if that film had never come to light? How much longer would it have taken the struggle to get to a point where some things changed if no one was watching and no one was listening? And I worry about that today, because for all the stories that have come forward from amateur videos and cell phone videos, there's still a million things a day that happen around the world where no one is watching and no one is offering a voice or a perspective. Because our society, when we lose empathy for one another, I don't know who had this quote, but it's something about, you know, empathy being the glue that absolutely holds the fabric of society together. And we're in danger of losing empathy for one another. The fact that, you know, people felt they couldn't go home for Thanksgiving this year and have any kind of family conversation about what was going on with the election or the world. When we lose empathy and the ability to hear each other and at least synthesize it. You don't always have to change your mind. You don't have to agree. But if you can at least synthesize where the other person is coming from and think about that a little bit and chew on that, that's critically important to a democratic society.
Karen Mathis is general manager of this radio station, and she spoke there with our reporter Jamala Henderson. In the coming months, a KUOW team is going to be looking into the way that racial dynamics and racial inequity shape the Seattle area. So if you have ideas for people to talk to or stories to tell, we would love to hear from you. So drop us a line at this address, newsroom@kuow.org. Again, newsroom@kuow.org. This is KUOW Seattle. Here are some words for you. Disgusting, fat, angry woman. There's rape everywhere. Shouldn't leave your phone at home, sweetie. No one would want to rape that fat, disgusting mess. Those are just a few of the things people have said online to Seattle writer Lindy West. The people who make online comments like that are commonly called trolls, and they'll make threats and throw insults, usually hiding behind a username that keeps them anonymous. And the conventional wisdom is ignore them. Don't respond to the trolls. Don't engage. Well, Lindy West has made a career of doing the opposite, calling out trolls who target women online. She wrote about that in her book, Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. Lindy West told Jeannie Yandel about a run-in she had with a commenter on Instagram.
There was some guy who had been sending me just ridiculous insults on Instagram, And
like what? What was he saying?
Oh,
to you?
He was. It was just like, oh, you're a fat loser, and your husband's a loser, and he married a whale, and you could eat a whole whale. And you're like, okay. And I clicked on his profile, and he was clearly like an adult man. Like he wasn't a 14-year-old boy. He was like a 35-year-old man. And I just wrote back like, what are you doing? Like, why are you doing this? And do your friends and family know that you harass women online for fun like a child? What is wrong with you, man? Like, what's wrong with your life? Why don't you go do something with your life? That's so embarrassing. It's so embarrassing. Can you imagine? And he was like, and he actually answered my question. He was like, no, they do not know that I do this. Please do not tell my girlfriend. She would be really mad at me. And so then I was like, oh, good idea. I just clicked on his account and there's all these pictures with his girlfriend who seems very nice. So I just sent her a message and I was like, hey, is this guy your boyfriend? Because he has been harassing me all week. And if it were my husband, I would want to know, you know, if my husband was doing this, I would want to know. So just FYI, here's a screenshot of the messages he's been sending me. You don't need to write back. I wish you well. Bye. And then and I told him, like, I had said back to him in the comments, like, oh, well, maybe I'll send her some screen grabs and she can help you. Because he had been like, I'm trying to get help for my trolling problem. So I was like, maybe your girlfriend, maybe I'll send her some screen grabs and then she can help you. And then he just started groveling and begging and was like, please do not contact my girlfriend. I love my girlfriend very much. And like sent me a picture of like a dinner from Benihana that he bought her. And I was like, I don't care, man. But it was just so pathetic and hilarious. And so anyway, and she never wrote back. My suspicion is maybe he like went into her phone and deleted it before she could read it. I don't know.
You don't just make a point of spending time outing and talking to people who come up with really uninteresting insults. You have also called people out who have said, frankly, awful, scary things. People who have threatened violence. Why do you think that that's an important thing to do as well?
Well, when I get really violent, scary comments, and you can tell which ones are threatening and which ones are just trying to get a rise out of you. Because some people are really viscerally scary. And those ones I don't really touch. I report those and block them. And I haven't gotten to the point where I was afraid enough to contact the police. But that's what I would do if it was a really specific, scary threat. You know, like, I'm going to come to your reading on this date and murder everyone, whatever. That's something where it's not like I would sass back on Twitter. I would quietly screen cap and report that to the police. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's a level of violent, but not so specific, you know, just still kind of unsettling threats that you get. And I don't know, with those, I don't usually respond to people directly, but I do sometimes post them because I think that a lot of people don't know the extent of this problem and what especially female writers and journalists are putting up with all day, every day, and how, I mean, cumulatively, it's really scary and it really makes you feel unsafe and targeted. So I don't know. I think one big reason why I engage with trolls on the internet is to make the problem visible to other people who aren't living with my Twitter feed. You know, that is really important to me. And also, there are a lot of especially younger women who are just thinking about entering journalism or writing or blogging who are nervous and who write to me and say, I want to do this, but I'm scared of trolls and I'm scared of being harassed. And so I feel like if I can talk back and fight back in a public way and embolden some of those women to maybe not be so scared and give them a script for dealing with their own trolls and, you know, be a model for how you can still do this job and not be chased away. That's really important to me, too.
In the book, though, you also talk about, I guess, what it's cost you. You talked about having to build up a kind of armor and that armor can be heavy. Do you think it's been worth the cost?
I think so.
How come?
I said that so fast, and now I'm not sure if that's true. No, I mean, it's definitely made me stronger. I mean, I used to be painfully shy, and the worst thing I could imagine was someone detecting my deepest insecurity and making fun of me for it. And now that happens to me every day. And it really, it's powerful that I've learned how to deal with that. It makes life a lot less scary. And I really feel like, as painful as it's been, I've learned a lot from being constantly harassed on the internet, because it makes you face your biggest anxiety, which is has always been people being mean to me, people not liking me. You know, everyone wants to be liked. I really want people to like me. I mean, good people. I don't care if Donald Trump likes me or whatever. But I mean, I wouldn't have a career if I cared what everyone thought about me, because a lot of what I do is criticize bad people. But, you know, I was always afraid of people yelling at me and people making fun of me. And it happens every day now, and I feel fine. And that's really empowering.
I'm remembering something you wrote in the book. You talked about, well, you talked about loving fantasy as a kid. You talked about kind of escaping into fantasy stories. And you compared fighting trolls online to fighting dragons a little bit. Maybe you've become this lady knight.
Yes.
And you fight.
Finally.
But you're not fighting one dragon. You're fighting an infinite number of dragons, it seems like. So I don't know. When do you get to stop? When do you get to hand the sword to somebody else?
Soon, probably. I'm bored of it. I am tired. No, you know, I don't have to do it forever. There are all kinds of really smart, radical young people who are taking over these internet spaces, and people who know a lot more about web development than I do. You know, I don't know how to fix internet trolling. I know how to critique culture, which I think is maybe the key component. You know, the problem isn't that Twitter exists, it's that misogyny exists. So that's the most effective way I can spend my time is writing this sort of feminist cultural critique. And I hope that I contributed in some way to people feeling like they can fight and they know how to.
Lindy West, Seattle's Lindy West, is author of the book Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. So there you heard her talking about how Twitter's not the problem. This weekend, Lindy West shut down her Twitter account. She wrote a column about it for The Guardian, and she said, quote, "Twitter for the last 5 years has been a machine where I put in unpaid work and tension headaches come out. I am micromanaged in real time by strangers. Neo-Nazis mine my personal life for vulnerabilities to exploit. And men enjoy unfettered direct access to my brain so they can inform me for the thousandth time that they would gladly rape me if I weren't so fat." Lindy West said the breaking point for her with Twitter was not the trolls, it was the company's refusal to stop them. We are tweeting out a link to her Guardian column now. Join us on Twitter at KUOW. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle, and I'm Bill Radke. Eastern Washington and Western Washington have always had a friendly rivalry. Cougars versus Huskies, apples and salmon, farms and forests. After the election, the political divide seemed to grow. Urban parts of our state got bluer, rural parts got redder, and Eastern Washington lawmakers are once again proposing we split Washington into two states. Writer Knute Berger understands why we tell ourselves this myth that there are two Washingtons, but he says that myth doesn't help Washingtonians.
In terms of the state, both sides really rely on each other. We're a state that relies on trade, and that includes Boeing planes. That also includes wheat. We rely on each other for water supplies. We rely on each other for infrastructure. A lot of the tax money generated on the west side of the state goes to pay for things on the east side of the state. And I think most people in the state, while they recognize that there are differences and tensions and kind of a political imbalance in terms of power, which is driven by where the population is, I think there is still a sense that, you know, we're one state, we're better off as one state.
Well, if there's a myth of two Washingtons, who's perpetuating the myth?
Well, You know, fairly routinely now, there's some legislators in eastern Washington who have a suggestion to split the state in two. And this goes way back. This has been discussed, you know, since the beginning. There are people who have wanted eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, and part of Idaho to become a state called Lincoln. But the current proposal in the legislature by some Spokane area representatives suggesting that we just cut the state in half at the Cascades and the east half will be called the State of Liberty and we can go our separate ways happily because the cultural and values and political differences are just too great.
Isn't it true that it is hard to govern a state with such split interests? Wouldn't it be a lot easier to govern states with a lot more where people have a lot more in common even a smaller area?
Right. That could be true. It depends on what kinds of resources you have to draw on. But I still think that we're stronger together, and I also don't think we're as divided as people might want to think. I mean, you know, while these ideas about dividing the state have always been percolating, people in the state are connected, you know, very directly. I mean, a lot of kids in eastern Washington come to the University of Washington. A lot of people in western Washington go to recreate in eastern Washington. I think there are just a lot more commonalities. But the thing I'm noting that has changed is, I think, with political partisanship being so much sharper than it used to be, the divide seems exaggerated.
Oh, so I think of over time, people becoming closer and learning about each other and getting to know each other better. Are you saying the East-West divide is actually hardening?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think, or at least some of the rhetoric about it is, and but the reality too. For example, politically, in the 1980s, the Speaker of the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. was a Washington Congressman, Tom Foley, who is a Democrat
from Spokane,
who represented a large swath of eastern Washington.
Yeah.
Likewise, in that same time period, our governor was John Spellman, uh-huh. a liberal Republican or a moderate Republican from the Seattle
From the
area.
West Side. Yeah,
yeah, from the West Side.
Yeah.
So our politics were a little more mixed. The parties had bigger tents. There was a little more variety. Now you have something where these political divides are much sharper. And my response to that is, instead of just dividing, I mean, you could go and divide many states around the country based on geography into smaller and smaller fiefdoms.
That's true. Most states have a rural-urban split of some
California
kind.
California does. You know, certainly on the West Coast we do. But there are a lot of states that have that split. And I think that, you know, we need agriculture. They need city culture, trade. So one of the things that I was remembering as I was thinking about this proposal to divide the state was that back in the 1980s, I was an editor at a magazine called Washington Magazine. And it was a statewide magazine, kind of a coffee table magazine with some substance to it. And our mission was what we called kind of lifting or parting the Cascade Curtain. We ran articles about eastern Washington that we thought would appeal to people in western Washington and vice versa. And we participated in a program that the Washington Association of Wheat Growers had, which was called the Farm City Swap.
And this was Farm City Swap.
And it was
come over here and we'll go over there.
Exactly. And so wheat ranchers in eastern Washington, you would fill out an application and they would match city people with farm people who had volunteered. And during harvest, like the busiest time of the year, mm-hmm. you would take your family over and spend a weekend on a wheat ranch. And then in the winter, the wheat family would come and visit you. The wheat family, yeah, and they visit you in Seattle or in, you know, anywhere in western Washington. Mm-hmm. It was such a fabulous program. We got such huge feedback from it.
Did you do it?
I did it, yeah.
You harvested wheat?
I've ridden in a combine. I was completely useless as a farmer, but I ate like a farmer.
You ate as if you'd built up that appetite from a hard day.
Exactly. I probably gained 6 pounds in a weekend, you know. they eat well during harvest, even though it's mostly mechanized now. Mm-hmm. But we went to church with the family. We met some of the neighbors. They took us out to Palouse Falls and some of the sights to see over there. But mostly it was just, we learned. And I remember the young man who was running the farm at the time. Family farm, been in it for some generations. His mother was kind of this Barbara Stanwyck, kind of ran everything, matriarch.
Mm-hmm.
But the son did the day-to-day, he and his family. And, he said, I said, well, this is a really hard job you have here. And he goes, no, it's not a job. This is a life. This is a lifestyle. We just live this. We do what's necessary whenever it's necessary. But this is just us. So there were some perspectives like that. And likewise, when people came to Seattle, they were struck, particularly those who visited farms in Western Washington.
Right.
And they were surprised. You know, they're like, wow, the tulip business,
yeah.
You know, or the orchards. Or they were also, I remember some of the comments that came in afterwards was people were fascinated with people over here who live on islands. And they could really relate to that because people on islands had to be more self-sufficient. There was a little more sense of community. And, you know, they were saying, wow, that's not so much different than living in a small wheat farm in the middle of nowhere, you know. And I just thought that program, the idea of that is something would be great to revive, not necessarily with wheat growers, but it could be with in some other way. I just think if East and West spent more time with each other, there wouldn't be this tendency to get so us and them-y about it. And I think it would generate a lot of understanding, even if politically we might disagree. You know, everybody would sort of all stay in the evergreen family.
Well, there's a proposal in Olympia to split us up. Knut and I are talking about getting together more often. I'd love to do that program.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Anybody in Eastern Washington want to invite me and a wife and three kids over? We'll come and not harvest very much. Great idea. Knut Berger is the Crosscut Mossback columnist, and it's good to see you again, Knut.
Good to see you, Bill.
Do you know a rancher family who will take my family in? And that's Knut Berger. If you want to hear more from him, tune in again to Friday's Week in Review, because Knut's going to join Joni Balter and Eli Sanders and me as we look over the week gone by, figure out what happened, understand it, and why it matters. Hope you can join us for the Week in Review Friday at noon. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. This morning, President Obama made a trip to the Capitol to meet with House and Senate Democrats. People who were there say Obama was organizing opposition to a Trump and Republican plan to repeal his Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. You can probably expect some kind of repeal or replace move to happen in this new year, 2017. Now, to anticipate the new year with us in a different way is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hello, Vaughn. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Bill.
And before we leave Donald Trump, he is part of Canada's calculation in 2017. What are Canadians anticipating from our Republicans?
Well, I think you could say the mood up here is the old Mel Brooks film title, High Anxiety.
Mm.
There's a lot of fretting and worrying going on.
About what, mostly?
Canada's Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, seemed to be on the same wavelength as Barack Obama on a whole bunch of issues, from climate change to trade issues, all that, international affairs. There's a long list of potential problems between Canada and the United States if Trump intends to go ahead and do everything he said he's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to reopen NAFTA. Canada's position on that is, well, okay, we'll talk about it, but, you know, we kind of like NAFTA the way it is. Softwood lumber, the agreement expired last fall. The expectation is Trump is going to be more protectionist, so we'll probably be facing trade action on our lumber exports to the United States. Climate action, Canada's just brought in a very fairly progressive program for carbon pricing, for taxing and cap and trade on climate action, and Trump seems to be headed the other direction on that. Taxes. It matters a lot to Canada in terms of investment what the tax rates are in the United States, because our tax rates need to be fairly competitive to attract investment. So Trump is talking about major cuts in corporate taxes, maybe personal income taxes as well, so that could create a competitive issue. Marijuana, international relations, there's a lot of issues where there could be a falling out, and I don't think anybody would suggest, other than a certain issue involving flashy celebrity hair, that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and President-elect Donald Trump are on the same page on very many other things.
Right. You've got your own election this spring, Vaughn. Liberals have had a mighty good run in British Columbia.
Yeah, it's, you know, British Columbia had a lot of political turmoil in the 1990s, six different premiers, and now we've got a government that's running for re-election in May on the 9th. Been in power for 16 years under two leaders and looking to run the string out to 20 years in power. There's doesn't happen very often anywhere that one party gets to govern for 20 years.
Right.
At the moment, Bill, the odds, you know, you don't want to predict too much in the political realm anymore. There's been so many surprises, and in fact, the Liberals in 2013 under Premier Christy Clark surprised a lot of observers by winning an election they were expected to lose. So our elections are close, they're competitive, but it's quite a string that the BC Liberals are hoping to run out. They're leading the country, Canada, in job creation and economic growth. So, you know, it's a fairly good thing to take to the electorate. But as you know, look around the world, it's the theme of time for a change has played out in a lot of places. So I think fair to say the Liberals are going to be running hard to win this re-election. They're not taking it for granted.
The main opposition, I think, is the New Democrats, but the Green Party is popular too. Could this be one of those third party splits the vote situations?
That's quite possible, Bill. There is a Green Party represented in the legislature. A climate scientist, Andrew Weaver, is their leader. Personally quite popular, and the opposition New Democrats led by John Horgan, a new leader, quite personable, very good communicator, a bit of a temper, but that's okay in this day and age, I think. I'll prove that. So I think we're in for a pretty tough election fight, and the opposition parties, particularly the New Democrats, are saying very nasty as well, so we could be in for a... Gee, Americans have no experience at all with nasty election campaigns, so...
Well, what do you have to be nasty about? What's the nastiness about it?
You know, the government's record, for one thing. When you've been in power for 16 years, there's an awful lot of stuff you've let slide, from education funding to health care funding, transportation for the disabled, and there's a long list of grievances against this government. And as I say, I think we've seen in the last couple of years all around the world that the theme of time for a change, let's give the system a shake-up, has worked. I think for that reason, the Liberals are wise not to take their win for granted. It wouldn't be unthinkable to see British Columbians finally have a change of government after 16 years on May the 9th.
And finally, Vaughn Palmer, as we talk about 2017, Canada's got a Jubilee birthday this year.
150 years old.
Yep.
Wow, they're, you know, a babe compared to the United States.
Yes.
Still.
But we'll give you advice.
1867, I'm not that kind of babe. We're not talking Trump.
Uh-huh.
Babe in the woods, I guess. But anyway, Canada's 150 years old this July the 1st. Back to 1867, what? President Andrew Johnson, William Seward buying Alaska, Civil War is just over in the United States,
good,
and four Canadian provinces band together to form Canada.
Four, I'm not sure I can name all four. Quebec, Ontario,
New Brunswick,
Nova Scotia. Oh, New Brunswick. I would have missed that
and
one.
And then British Columbia joined in 1871, but we're going to be celebrating anyway because there's nothing British Columbia likes better than a party. Federal government's going to spend a couple of $100 million staging parties and what is it? 150 years is sesquicentennial, I think.
I believe that's right.
150th. Anyway, there'll be events all across Canada, so come on up. There'll be lots of stuff to enjoy.
Having seen the movie Waiting for Guffman, those Waiting for Guffman fans know the phrase sesquicentennial. I believe that is correct.
Oh, okay.
And you did very nicely on American history as well, Vaughn, as we look forward to 2017 Canada style. Good to talk with you again. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Bye-bye.
Vaughn Palmer, columnist at Vancouver Sun, joining us regularly here on KUOW. And finally, coming up on KUOW, the Leaning Tower of San Francisco. There is a luxury high-rise. I've seen it in San Francisco. It's sinking and tilting, and people live there. And you will hear the entire story this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. We're live tweeting at KUOW. Get our podcast, won't you, at KUOW.org or on iTunes or wherever you go to get the very best podcasts.